Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Ludvig Göransson is without a doubt one of the most accomplished and distinctive film composers of the 21st century. In 2020, after having worked on Tenet together, acclaimed director Christopher Nolan hired Göransson again to score what has become one of the biggest movies of 2023, Oppenheimer. Ludvig, who emigrated to Los Angeles from his native Sweden in 2007, has racked up dozens of writing, producing, and scoring credits. He started out working in TV and oversaw music on hit shows like Community, New Girl, and The Mandalorian. He eventually started scoring films with his old college friend, Ryan Coogler. Ludvig composed music for all of Ryan's hit movies, including Fruitvale Station, the Creed series, and both Black Panther films, the first of which won him the Academy Award for Best Original Score in 2019. On today's episode, I talked to Ludvig Göransson about his incredible body of work as a composer and producer. He explains how his rigorous musical training in Sweden prepared him to write the complex sections of Oppenheimer's score. Ludvig also plays some of the more moving sections of the score for us in an effort to show us how he came up with one of the best soundtracks of the year. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's my conversation with Ludvig Göransson.
Congratulations, I should say, on the success of Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. And also like just the reception to the music has been... It's been incredible. I'll say I always go into movies trying to know nothing. So if I hear, you know, Christopher Nolan's put on a movie about Robert Oppenheimer and Robert Downey Jr.'s in it and Cillian Murphy, I'm like, great. That's as much as I want to know. And as I was going through it, I was like, this music is incredible. So as soon as I got out, I went to pull it up so I could listen to it on the drive home. And I was like, oh, fuck. It was I had no idea it was you who was doing the music.
Yeah.
It was so good, man.
Thank you.
When did the project come to you?
It came to me about right as Kris had finished writing the script. And we had done a movie before called Tenet.
Yeah.
And that was an incredible experience. Obviously, I've been well aware of Kris movies and Kris films and the music, the way he uses music in his storytelling and the incredible scores by Hans Zimmer and David Julian and the things that they did on Batman. And he had a huge influence in, I think, every film composer's life. And it also transcended just film composing. It changed films, I think, and the sound of film.
What did you notice about it? Before you started working with them, what had you noticed about it?
Well, how much front and center the music is in his films and how much they're driving the story and how important it is to the energy and to the tempo and the feel of his films. And it's like his own character. And that's something, you know, when you're getting started in this career, trying to write music for film, you know, and you go to the theater and it's not every time you go see a movie and you really hear the music.
Yeah.
You know, and I think with Chris films, that's, you go to see his films and it's a real experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's like, it's not often you go to the movies and you feel like the score is so prominent. Like if the music is prominent, it's often a needle drop, and that feels like the song, you know, the NWA song or the Rolling Stones song that you're hearing that you already have an emotional attachment to, that becomes a character in the movie. But it is very rare in modern cinema to feel so attached to film music as much as you do when you go to see a Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah.
How conscious are you of that while you're writing the score for a Christopher Nolan movie?
I'm not thinking about, you know, when I'm in the moment and writing the music, I am thinking about the vision of the director. You know, what is he or she imagining? What's the things that I can't see in the script? What are the things that I can't see when I see the film for the first time? And sometimes I even want the director to talk to me like I'm an actor, or tell me as much as possible about this film, having as many conversations about the script, and as much input as I can get about what their vision is, the more helpful it's going to be for me to create the world of music and the sound world for the film.
So when Christopher Nolan reached out with the Oppenheimer script, what was the message to you?
Well, first, he didn't say anything, so I didn't even know what it was about when I sat down to read it.
Just gave it to you or sent it to you?
No. I go to his office and read it because they don't give out the scripts.
You had no clue at all.
No, so I go there. I'm obviously super excited, and I sit down in a room, and I'm in it for a three and a half hour journey. It was extremely exhilarating. I remember reading the script for the first time. It was so capturing. Just being in his life, like seeing the world through his eyes and feeling what he was feeling in those moments. Like everything was written from the first person perspective. So it was an incredible emotional experience reading it for the first time.
At what point do you start allowing yourself to think about music in relation to the script as you're reading that?
Well, I'm starting immediately thinking about the possibilities and where to go. And I also know that obviously this is my second film with Chris, so I know that he's open for any ideas. And then shortly after I read the script, we have a conversation. And the only direction he gave me was that he was very interested in seeing how we could have the violin portray the personality of Oppenheimer.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do with that?
So, and also Chris knows that my wife Serena Gornison is a very accomplished violinist, and we were fortunate that he wanted to take that route because that comes very handy. We would have a wife that's also a violinist, and we were able to experiment long hours in the studio with things that kind of, after a while, drive both of us a little crazy. just kind of try to make the violin sound in ways that I haven't heard before, and trying to manipulate it with audio and sound effects and turning it around. But a lot of the experimentation also came from the conversations I had with Chris in terms of how we can go from, you know, Oppenheimer is very neurotic, but there's also scenes where he's incredibly, you know, confident, and we wanted to go from something at times very beautiful and confident to something completely neurotic and horrifying. And how can we go between those feelings with a split of a second on the violin with just the performance of a vibrato or doing a microtonal glissando up and down, you know?
Yeah. On first viewing, one of the things that struck me was the decision that I loved for essentially the climax of the movie, which is the testing at Trinity, for it just to go silent.
Yeah.
Blank.
Yeah.
Was that in the script from the beginning?
Yeah, no, that's what's, you know, so many things are in the script. Like I felt like when we finished the movie, and it was almost like reading the script again. I mean, it's the foot stomps are in the script, the pause of silence in the script, everything. I feel like he has probably tempo and music in his mind while he's writing these movies.
So was the violin the first explorations?
Yeah, so the violin, we were recording long hours here in my studio, and I was doing half, like very long kind of glissandos, trying to make sounds like almost like air raid sirens. But after a while, I knew that the most important thing to get right from the beginning was the emotional core of the story. And it's easy sometimes when you start working on a project and you start just messing around with production and sounds, and like you're trying to, you can hide things behind cool sounds or behind effects and sounds. And I feel like you tend to do a lot of that when you write on the computer, because you use technology and the way you see music on the computer is very horizontal and vertical.
Yeah.
So for me, it was important to get the emotional core right. And lately, it's mostly the last couple of years, I feel like stepping away from the computer is helping me with feeling more creative.
Will you ever just sit down with some staff paper?
Yeah, I mean, sitting by the piano, writing with staff paper, or sitting by the roads, or picking up the guitar, or whatever. I mean, I'm not an expert in all instruments, but I can cheat on a few. So a lot of these themes were actually written on the piano. And I remember the specific Oppenheimer theme came about after we recorded hours of air raid sirens. And we were kind of going crazy. And I just sat down on the piano and just played this bass melody. Super simple bass line. Do, 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 do.
Do you mind showing me?
Yeah.
That's Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of like this. I put that in like low cellos, a low bass and cellos. In a slow tempo. And then I added this melody.
It's and, really stunning. Gosh.
And then beautiful. Right after I wrote that on the piano, I asked Serena to play it. And the way she performed it was just like, it's incredible, beautiful, intimate performance with almost no vibrato, like very fragile, was perfect.
Yeah.
And I sent that to Chris. And then he called me back like 20 minutes later and was like, this is it. You know, this Oppenheimer's theme.
Wow. And did you think of it as the theme, or were you just thinking of it as...
No, I knew it was kind of special, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And did you, at this point, again, you don't have you've read the script, mm-hmm. but do you have it yet?
I read the script and I had it in my head.
But nothing to reference as you get back. And
they hadn't shot the film, but something that's really cool that Chris Nolan does is he brings... people in very early. He brings me in very early in the process. So while he's having tests, you know, with visual effects and with also costume tests, and he invites me in to see the screenings of those tests at IMAX Theater. And I'm sitting there in IMAX Theater, you know, watching these incredible visual effects that he worked on with Andrew Jackson, and some incredible experiments that I remember at the time was I felt... almost like I was dreaming when I was sitting in that room. It was a black, dark theater. and seeing these kind of fluorescent lights like swirling around you, spinning faster and faster and faster, and then it's cutting and I see fire coming out, and it's like, just feel very lucky to like, you know, go on a Monday morning is like, watch this in a theater, and then come out of there, it's like, oh, this tremendous inspiration to like, some of that things that I saw really inspired me to help me to realize what I wanted the music to sound like. Like that sense of energy that I saw on screen.
It's incredible that he had essentially already had the theme locked in before shooting. Like that gives it almost like, I mean, you, as you say, it's all there in the script.
Yeah.
But the music does add an extra emotional element. I'm sure that must have helped to some degree the emotional contents of what was on camera. You know?
Yeah. No, it maybe wasn't as black and white where like it was like, this is his theme, but like I think we both knew that it was special because we don't want to jinx anything. You don't want to like, because you never really know if it's gonna work until you actually sit down
lay it in
with the edit, and that's when you really can. But I feel like, I mean, I've done two films with Chris, and so far we've been pretty good at trajectorying the sound and the feeling of the music before.
Do you think about it thematically? I mean, because there's two things happening here. There's like this really kind of quiet, personal story. And then it's almost like the second, the co-star is a nuclear bomb, you know, or an atomic bomb, which is insane. Like, how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, no, it was very, it was a really tough movie to write the music for, especially because it is such a personal journey. The feelings that you need to put the audience inside of him, like the audience shouldn't sit in the theater judging him, they should be there on his journey, feeling what he feels. And that's what the music needs to do. And the only way to do that is kind of I need to put myself into his shoes too. And some of it is some of those feelings of like sadness and loneliness and emptiness and kind of how the searching for something, how the movie starts and how the music starts. That was a little easier for me to kind of navigate through and being able to, I've been in some of those emotional states before, but yeah. And then there's that scene of like inspiration when he's going through, he sees a Picasso painting on the wall and you see that, you see a Picasso painting on IMAX screen. It's insane.
Yeah.
It really had a big effect on me. And then he's in bed and he sees this atom swirling around and around, like it moves faster and faster, and like writing that kind of exhilarating music is so fun and also at times also mathematically challenging for me. And it was really interesting how I had to like combine the emotional but also with the theory, which is also kind of part of my background in education and how you can use theory and what is it, theory only takes it so far.
Yeah.
And but then there's also these more complicated emotions and feelings, like when he's done the first Trinity test and he's about to have his congratulatory speech to his team and to his, you know, to all the scientists, and he's having a fucking panic attack.
One of the most striking things I've seen in a long time.
Yeah. And that was just, it's so complex and it's so that visceral and cathartic, that experience. I remember they had that even reading the script, and that was so hard to imagine. So that was the last piece of the puzzle that we did on the movie, that score.
You left it for the end, or you were trying?
No, we tried it over and over and over again. It wasn't until the last day of the dub when we solved that piece of music.
How did it change?
I tied it into an earlier feeling, an earlier emotion, an earlier scene in the movie, which is the scene when he goes to Los Alamos for the first time, and he's watching these stars. He's watching these stars getting swallowed by a black hole, and he's talking about, what if I could, you know, be here in Los Alamos and do the thing I love the most and work, you know, work it and combine my passion with science. And this is the first time I'm kind of using these synthesizers that it kind of feels like the impending doom. Mm. And these synthesizers are just kind of pulling you downwards in like a downward spiral. And I don't know how I thought about it, but I was like, what if we take that feeling and that emotion and put it in this scene again? And it worked.
you were trying something completely new.
Something that just had like a horror elements, like something just, I was going with that feeling of like horror and shocking. But it wasn't until it got that kind of emotional depth to it that it started to feel real. I also don't want to make it seem like the music had a big part of that scene.
No, but you don't want to like the job you have that is very hard is you don't want to put too much of a mark on it, but you also don't want to fuck up what's on the screen. And you can undercut the moments.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like it's one of the best, I think, moments of cinema of all time, that scene.
Yeah.
And that emotion and how many, I never felt like that before seeing a film.
We have to take a quick break. Then we'll come back with more of my conversation with Ludvig Göransson.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora: to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
We're back with more from Ludvig Göransson.
Earlier you said mathematically, I think the phrase you used was mathematically complex. Or, what did you mean by that? Like the score was...
There's some parts in the score where I've... was able to get ideas out with music that I haven't been able to achieve before. With that, I'm describing those scenes where you feel like there's a constant tempo change, like everything's getting faster and faster and faster. And I was trying to channel the feelings of the energy of constantly pushing the boundaries of energy forward, like the spinning atoms. And the way that I achieved that was through math, with having constant tempo changes in a way where it didn't make musically sense. So in a way you can kind of only do it on the computer. It's 21 tempo changes in this piece of music. But what made it human was we had it did it all with the live string ensemble, recorded that all those tempo changes live in one continuous performance. So, but that was also a lot thanks to math and to the computer that I was able to do this kind of interesting tempo changes with this hexatonic string pattern. It's a six-note scale that I was working with at the time. And that six-note scale is something that I had in my toolbox from college.
Did you mind showing us what a hexatonic, what a hexatonic scale is and maybe how that translated to some degree to what?
Yeah, so basically, a hexatonic scale is a six-note scale. And you can make a six-note scale from two chords that doesn't have any similar notes with each other. So two chords that doesn't have any of the same notes with each other is like a B minor and a C major. Yeah, so that makes this scale. So, and out of these six notes, you can make patterns, right? So that's just a basic.
And that's combining a B minor scale with the C major scale.
A B minor chord.
B minor chord.
So the B minor chord is B, D, F sharp. And then the C major chord is C, E, G. So that's six notes.
So arpeggiating both of those.
So I'm starting with the B minor, C major. And then I'm doing the B minor again by starting the third on the minor third. And then the major third of the C major. Fifth, the B minor, the fifth, the C major. And you can make a thousand different patterns within these six notes. You know, like. You know, so one of the patterns that I ended up making for this movie is this.
Why do you think the hexatonic scale came to you as like a tool for this?
I think a lot of music ideas come to me, and I think to creative people, I think you get a lot of ideas in general to anyone from like your childhood or from like the times when you felt like sense of inspiration and I think maybe seeing the scene when he's in college somewhere studying and he sees things for the first time, this Picasso painting, he's throwing glass at the wall, he's listening to Rite of Spring, he's like discovering all these things for the first time.
Yeah. Those early scenes in the film.
Yeah, and I was that made me think about when I discovered things for the first time, where when I was in college and I was playing these type of scales and I was, you know, playing with starting a band for the first time, my first jazz quintet and I mean, I honestly can't remember exactly what it is, but I think a lot of times you look at yourself and you draw from those moments that had such an impact on you, those first time memories. You know, your first kiss. You don't remember how it feels, but it's deeply rooted inside of you somewhere.
An emotional memory, more necessary sometimes.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And there is something about that that is a little fractured sounding.
It almost sounds like a scale you're practicing on something but then I wanted to make it feel like you're like really mastering it in the end, you know, how even
drilling it, mastering it. I love it's so funny, it is really like feels like three different films in a weird way to me, you mm-hmm. know. I could really enjoy any of the acts on their own isolated. The first act's a great movie.
Yeah.
The second act is, I mean, just the Trinity stuff is out of out of control. How did you start processing the Trinity stuff from a composition standpoint versus the early stuff?
With the Trinity stuff is up until that point when they start preparing for the Trinity test, yeah. Everything's been scribbles on a notepad or theories or conversations. And when you see the bomb for the first time, the actual bomb, the physical thing, it's like, I wanted the music to change character there. So I kind of threw all the organic elements on the side and just changed the tone of the music a little bit and had focused more on sound design and used like three elements, which is one of them being like this throbbing bass, this thumping bass, which almost sounds like a heartbeat. And then you have a little ticking sound, like kind of like a Geiger counter, like and then these crackling sound effects that sounds kind of like a nuclear reaction or something. Yeah. And that's just those three elements. And it's a big shift of the music in the film to that point. I mean, it's already kind of like that oh shit moment, but like you're literally there at that moment. You're like, they could blow up the whole world. Yeah. they could kill all of us.
They still can.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I would say one of the other important parts of the puzzle was to find the right theme for Kitty, and which is kind of the love theme, and she's the person that really holds him down, and angers yeah. him as a person, and you can tell that she's making a lot of the big decisions too. I think. And she's such an interesting character. And I think the relationship they had, I think, was very special and beautiful.
Yeah.
And important to him. So I wanted her theme to feel completely like almost like the yin to his yang.
Yeah.
And
it certainly seemed like he needed her.
Yeah. But in the end, like the way that they're working together, and then especially the last thing where she's testifying, how important that was.
Oh my God, yeah, right.
And so I wanted her, her theme has the richness of the piano, and it's also a waltz, and it starts with these chords that are just have these long pauses in between them to kind of highlight the tension, because the scenes where she is in, like, there's so much tension. Like, her performance is incredible. Like, especially, when she's at the
deposition.
Yeah,
the deposition. Oh, my God.
She's witnessing and you're having these chords. And, like, you don't know where it's going to go. Is she going to make it or break it, But they just, I feel like the way it grows just kind of makes you feel like how strong of a character she is. And then you have the cello melody playing her theme. And then the violin melody, who's Oppenheimer's instrument, kind of joins in the middle, and it becomes a waltz, and the two cellos and the violin are playing against each other, and it's almost like they're dancing together.
Ooh. Do you mind playing some of those warm chords? Yeah. I would just love to hear the kind of what you're...
We're going to pause briefly, then come back with more from Ludvig Göransson.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
We're back with the rest of my conversation with Ludvig Göransson.
Jazz was sort of early on where your interest laid musically, right?
Yeah, that's where it went in high school and college.
When did classical music enter your life, if ever?
It was right before I got into jazz, actually. It was like around the same time I got into jazz, a little earlier. And first I was into heavy metal and rock and instrumental rock and guitar shredding and heavy dark metal. Then I got into pop music and I wanted to be part of the Cheiron studio in Stockholm, like working on Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys and like that was in
churning out the factory hits. Everyone, those are good stuff.
Part of that was in high school, being part of Max Martin's studio, and I think that kind of went hand in hand with me being very interested in technology at an early age. Like I loved being able to record myself. I had like a 4-track portable recorder that I was experimenting with at home, and if you turn the cassette tape on the other side, like half of the tracks went backwards, and then I got a 8-track, 8-at-a-quarter, and just messing around with that and drum machines. And there was something about technology that kind of spruced my interest in recording myself. And I mean, I was always playing, recording myself and playing it for my parents and listening to it, obviously, over and over by myself. I guess it became a way where you could really hear yourself, how you were playing, and you could get better, and you could hear, okay, I really need to practice on this, or really practice on that. And then I had a program on my computer called like Impulse Tracker, where I was able to program like one zeros and ones and make music that way. That was before I had Cubase and that stuff.
Pre-Cubase.
Yeah, pre-Cubase, pre-DAW. Yeah, and then getting a synthesizer and being able to just play around with that and hearing those, like, creating weird sounds. And I also went to music elementary school, so all my friends were also in music, and I was able to start a band. And we had a very, very cool band together called Thrombosis in sixth grade.
Thrombosis?
Yes, like a hardcore band.
Did you record the group?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I was the recording engineer and the mixer. And we made a little tape and we sold it at the local record store for $2. And then we got a review in our local newspaper, 2 out of 5.
Exhilarating.
No, it was heartbreaking.
Really?
We were so depressed.
That's your first go, you know, to even get picked up. That's something.
Yeah, but in our minds, this was the best music ever created.
Of course. Of course. Do you remember anything that they said in the review?
I think they were trying maybe a little to make it sound nice, like where you, these guys go in sixth grade or starting out. But it was kind of like, it felt like belittling.
Yeah.
Because we thought we were competing with the real gang, so the real boys.
The big dogs.
Yeah, the big dogs.
It's very unique, I guess, to have grown up so far away from, you know, like New York, LA,
mm-hmm.
and to have had like a Max Martin there making music around, you know?
Yeah, and this was before that I was into that Max Martin pop music. This was when like our town where we were from was all in like hardcore scene.
Yeah,
like we had Millencolin in Sweden, and then we had some other. They were not from my hometown, but we had other like hardcore bands from my town called. One was called Nine, and one was called Outlast. And it was a pretty cool time. And then I remember seeing when I saw Meshuggah for the first time in like seventh grade or sixth grade, and that was a cool experience.
Does that stuff still resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. They are like probably the only metal band I still listen to.
Meshuggah?
Yeah. One of my favorite live bands. So.
Did you guys view American hardcore and metal as being a little watered down?
It was hard to have access to that music, for me at least.
I guess Metallica, though, would have been like that big was, or mean, something, right?
Of course. Yeah, that was like the dream, right? That was at least my dream band, my... And I think also in our culture in Sweden and Scandinavia, it's like you always look up to America. And I think that's in every kind of fields.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is it true that you discovered USC just on the internet? Like you had no idea
mm-hmm.
what USC was? You had never heard of it?
Yeah. It was very complicated to try to find colleges and try to find schools. And I had to do it, you know, all by myself. No counseling, no, all that was so foreign. Like, this was 2006, so the websites were still kind of ugly looking.
Yeah, and very rudimentary. Yeah.
And I'd never been to the States. I didn't know anyone in the States. It was very, 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 very far. The closest relationship at the States was probably like the Bret Easton Ellis books that I was reading at the time.
Oh, yeah. That's a great view of America you must have gotten. Jesus. Surprised you came. Why LA over New York?
I knew that I wanted to do film scoring.
Got it.
I had gotten really into film scoring. I'd gotten to work with an orchestra in high school, and having them perform my music for the first time, like having written music for orchestra, 70 people that was playing my music in a concert hall, was that feeling was transcending everything else. So it's like trying to think about how I can do that again. And also the music that I wrote was very much like John Williams and if Star Wars was in Nightmare Before Christmas. And I knew that after that I wanted to become better on my instrument. And also in Sweden, like the only kind of route you can take is through education, and one of the most difficult schools to get into was the Royal College of Music in jazz and guitar.
Which you did,
and
right?
And after I didn't get in the first time, so I had to take a year off and like practice more. And I went to another school called the People's School, where you just in the middle of nowhere just play on your instruments and you just play around, you know,
the countryside, like outside.
Yeah, countryside, and there's everyone in your class is just there to play, and it's amazing. And then I got in.
What did you have to audition?
Yeah.
What did you have to do to get in?
It was nerve-wracking because it was, I think, I don't know, 100 people applying for 2 spots. You know, and these are 100, like I would say half of those 100 are like really good at their instrument. And it's the first day of audition. You play a song, you play standard, any standard you want.
Autumn that, Leaves, maybe, whatever.
Yeah, I think my first edition, I played a Pat Metheny song that's on
Damn.
His trio album. It was a song called Never Too Far Away from Pat Metheny's album Questions and Answers. Mm. And so you play, the first day you play one song and then you stay at school the whole day and you're just nerve-wracking, just waiting for that list to get put on the wall.
Who makes the next cut?
And, you know, and there's 20 people go to the next round. And then day two, if you're lucky enough to be able to make it day two, then there's, I think, a sight reading test. There's, I think, just improvisation tests where they put some chords in front of you and just improvise. And then the band is playing like five different tempos and different time signatures. And then you have to, after that, you have to wait. And then there's also like a theater test, a piano test. And then you have to wait for 3 months or something like that.
Crazy.
Yeah. And there, and so you do that test in like Stockholm, Gothenburg, and Malmö, which is the three cities that has the College of Music.
Goddamn. Was it gutting to not get in?
Yeah. Because I was most of the times I always kind of, most of my life I had kind of like a, in music, I always kind of got, I set up goals for myself that I always made.
You must have had supreme confidence in yourself. Yeah. If you're showing up playing some Matheny. Yeah.
I definitely had confidence because of like my band is in high school and got to write the music for the orchestra. And then, but it was very important part of my career to finally get into the Royal College of Music and then not being the best of my instrument, being like feeling like shit. I had to practice for 2 years every day, three, four hours a day.
Do you think you really got much better?
Oh, yeah. That's how I spent the first 2 years. And then the last year, I started my own band and we won a bunch of competitions. And it was kind of like, oh, look, I was able to. You didn't think that I was going to do this. Yeah.
So you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you felt like just moving to LA without some sort of structure felt maybe a little, you put yourself too far out on a limb. And that's why you decided to try out USC?
Yeah, I don't think you can even move to LA as a tourist. Oh, I mean, you could live there for 3 months.
That's a great point. You would have had to have a job. How would you get a job unless you're here and you can't get here without the job?
Yeah,
right.
That would have been impossible. So I had won a couple of film music competitions. In one of them was in Netherlands, and the first prize of when I won that competition was to score a commercial. So I got a job for like a music commercial house in Netherlands, and I was still in Stockholm. This was right before I finished college, but that was like a very to me, winning that competition and talking and doing like a film scoring job was like pretty cool, and I knew that I had potential in this, and I also scored a couple of student features in Stockholm. So I applied to USC. I found, you know, I found the website. I think it was, I found the school in New York, found a school in LA, maybe one in England and one in Australia. And I only applied to the one in LA because I wanted, that's the film, the type of films that I wanted to work on. And I got a phone call from the professor, Brian King. And he was the head of my program at the time. And he was like, hey man, this is Brian calling you from LA. It's sunshine every day. You have to move here. You're going to love it, bro. I was like, okay. Sounds amazing. Sounds great.
Great California yeah. pitch. That's the typical. Yeah.
With that like super positive voice.
You're going to love it, bro.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, hell yeah.
Right.
I'm totally doing this. My parents were a little hesitant, but yeah, I made the move. Didn't know anyone in LA first year was very difficult.
LA is hard when you don't mm-hmm. know people and you don't know the lay of the land. It's not very forgiving if you just...
No, it was like I was crying every night for like at least the first 3 months.
I can only imagine.
On the bus back from UC on Venice Boulevard back to Culver City.
Wow.
And so I found I moved closer to UC and... I moved into it was a fraternity house that then they had thrown out the fraternity, so it was only open for grad students.
Oh, great.
And then it literally felt like I was walking into American Pie. I didn't know the culture, but everyone on my street was partying every night, and it was great. I mean, I was...
That is a strong era for USC. It's falling on hard times right now, but that 2006 or 7 USC,
yeah,
that's a strong era.
It was amazing. I was in my little room working with headphones every night and just like opening up the blinds and seeing like these dudes and no shirt and drinking alcohol from those red cups and having the life. And that's also where I met Ryan in that housing.
Like pretty quickly, it seems like you started getting work. You know, within a couple of years, mm-hmm. I mean, you got Marley and me. You know,
I mean, yeah, I was the assistant for Theodore Shapiro, who scored Marley and Me, and he was scoring Tropic Thunder at the time. So I had just finished college, and that was my first job, and it was amazing.
Must have been fucking incredible.
Yeah,
Marley and Me was a huge movie. You know,
yeah, it was like. Marley Me and Tropic Thunder.
Huge.
Like Ben Stiller was in the room when we were recording. I was just obviously a fly on the wall sitting in the back, you know, but like had to pinch myself a couple of times to like see that I had really gotten this job. And then also Teddy, I was working with Shapiro, he was also an incredible guy. Like I had a lot of my friends in my class got jobs for other composers that were not nice, you know, and but the Teddy that I was working for was incredible.
He seemed to just really take a liking to you.
Mentored me, you know, taught me so much about, you know, the crafts of film scoring, because it's writing music for film is, there's definitely a craft to it, writing music, especially when, I mean, timing is everything.
How long did it take you to figure out the various processes that are involved?
I think I was Teddy's assistant for about 2 or 3 years, and I was just looking at the craft and looking at how you craft the scene and how you craft where the music ends, where it starts, how you build it up. And also at UC I had some great professors, and the reason why I wanted to go there was that all of the professors are kind of working in the business too.
Yeah.
But after, I think it was about 2010 or 2009, I think I got my first job, which was Community.
Right.
And that was an incredible chance for me to get that TV show. And it was a big chance for me. And the Russo brothers hired me, and Dan Harmon.
How did you meet them?
On Teddy's recommendation, because they had worked with him before and he didn't have time to do this show. And he said, like, my assistant's great. And that show was, I put, you know, all my time, 12 hours in a day in making music for that show. And it was the greatest training because, you know, the Russo brothers really cared about the music. Dan Harmon really cared about the music. We scored it with live orchestra a couple of episodes. And one episode was a Lord of the Rings spoof. One episode was like a Star Wars spoof. Like, I got to do all these styles of music.
Yeah.
So I got really kind of trained my chops. And the music had a huge part in this show. And then after that, I got, because the music supervisors on that show referred me to Elizabeth Merriweather, who did New Girl, and she hired me for that show. And then
that would have been like 2012, 11 or something. Yeah.
And then Happy Endings was another show that I did. And I was really into like the sitcom show. I had like 3 shows on network, on air every week.
It's huge.
Yeah.
That must have been, it must be a grind.
Yeah. And I was like 27 maybe.
Were you still feeling like, dang, I want to get a movie?
Yeah, I was starting to get a little bit, not nervous, but I definitely felt like, oh, I can do this for the rest of my life. I can see how you can really just, because it's so hard to say no. Like someone's asking for another TV show. Hey, you want to do this TV show?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Like yeah. I'm going to meet new people, going to get another good paycheck, and I can like make my team bigger. And there's, you know, I could have easily taken on 10 TV shows a week and like kind of made myself, you know, an incredible life.
That's another version of a incredible Ludwig Göransson life, you know?
Yeah. But creatively, maybe I wouldn't have been as content as I am now, maybe.
I'm sure, probably to some degree. Is there anything that to this day that if you think about makes you wince a little?
Wins, I mean, what?
Just an experience like you fucked something up,
oh.
Or where you just sort of feel like I wish I'd done that different, even, or I wish I had just.
Maybe I can look back and it's like, okay, well, I didn't need to do that project. but it's at when you're started, when you get started, and like it's, you know, you don't, you're also learning when to say no. And but I think definitely the most challenging projects I worked on was definitely like the last 2 years going from Wakanda and straight into Oppenheimer, like this, just the weight of both projects and like them being so a huge movie, two huge movies,
yeah, two, you know, huge.
Back to back.
Yeah.
And that had, both of them had a heavy weight to it.
We were talking before, I got a 5 and a 7 year old, yeah, man. So Trolls World Tour is big in my, in my house. I got to say that soundtrack is banging. How was working on that with like with Justin Timberlake and Anderson and, .Paak? And
yeah, that was a lot of fun. I'd done Awaken My Love. I was about to do Mandalorian, or I had started out with Mandalorian. I think I got an Oscar for Panther 1, and I was doing Trolls World Tour right before Tenet. But I didn't do the score, I was doing the songs. And I just thought it was so fun because it's obviously the whole story was driven by music.
Yeah.
So we get the chance to do all these covers and to do all these original songs. And
were you able to help in the selection of some of the songs?
Yeah, no. Yeah. I was very, very much part of everything. Like me, like Justin and me worked close together on the selection of songs. And then also in terms of like how we made the originals, you know, we got Anderson .Paak on this, on one or two songs.
His originals on there are so, yeah, good. They're really good.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I got to work with Max Martin on a song. SZA, James Fonroy did a song with him. Good group people, fun people.
Your range as you're listing that off, and it's like, yeah, Black Panther and Tenet and Trolls World Tour. Yes. But I was like, oh my God. The range is just and out of control.
A Haim song too. We did the Rock and Roll Rules. It was like the
Rock and Roll Rules. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
What, so you're trying to kind of thin out your schedule a bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. What's kind of going to, how do you, your guiding sort of light or principle going forward, how are you going to know what to say yes to and what to say no to?
I mean, I feel like I have a pretty good sense of my next 5 years or my next 10 years, that the type of projects that I want to do, I constantly want to challenge myself. And I also feel I'm very fortunate to be working with collaborators and people that I think are really pushing the format and film forward and pushing the music forward. And so I'm just taking a little, like, a breather and waiting for the craziness to start up again, maybe middle next year. I actually don't know.
Are you committed to a couple projects already?
I know. I'm just working on my own music right now. My own album. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
How far into that are we?
I started it 2018, and then Black Panther 1 came along, so I got like 50% done, and then I started again to 2019, and I got like 80% done, and then another movie came along. So it's like, I just like, okay, I need to finish this now before the next thing starts. Yeah.
What's it sound like? What's the?
It's kind of like psychedelic, quirky, proggy, all organic elements, and I'm trying to sing too.
Cool, man. Well, thanks so much, man. Congratulations on all the success, man. Thanks for all the incredible music, man, from stuff that I just enjoy putting on myself to this, you know, giving my kids something to put on that won't make me want to jump out the car. It's like, just, you know, appreciate you having you out in the musical universe.
No, thank you for having me on this podcast, and so nice to talk to you, and yeah, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Thanks to Ludvig Göransson for having me to a studio to break down his approach to film scoring and composition. You can hear his work on the Oppenheimer soundtrack, along with a sample of his other music, on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced and edited by Leah Rose, with marketing help from Eric Sandler and Jordan McMillan. Our engineer is Ben Tolliday. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries.
If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.